This episode of Game Master's Journey is brought to you by the patrons and other supporters of Starwalker Studios. Find out more about becoming a patron, as well as all the other great ways you can support the show at starwalkerstudios.com/support. Starwalker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 200 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 26 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. First of all, I want to wish everyone a happy new year. Happy new year, everyone. This is the first episode for 2018 for Game Master's Journey, and also the first episode of season 12 of the show. I'm really excited. This is kind of a landmark episode for me. It's episode 200. It's the first episode of season 12. And this is like my third year doing the show. Insane. And I've got a lot of great content planned for you for season 12. We're going to have more discussion episodes on the DMG. We're going to have more discussion episodes on the planes. We're going to have more interviews. We're going to have more actual play. We're going to have more behind the screens episodes, all kinds of great stuff. So I'm really excited for the new year, really excited for the new season, and really excited to see where we can get today. This season, as far as GMs, improving our GMing, networking with one another, sharing ideas, all that great stuff. So for today's episode, I'm going to return to my exploration and discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide. Now, I thought about doing some kind of crazy, you know, episode 200 celebration episode like I did for episode 100, but I gave it a lot of thought, and you may disagree, and I'd love to hear from you if you disagree, but me personally, I hate those kinds of episodes on other podcasts that I listen to. I tend to skip them or not listen to the whole thing. They seem very self-serving and boring and lacking in real content. So I decided not to do a special episode. I decided to do a real episode with real RPG discussion content for you. So like I said, today we're getting back to our Dungeon Master's Guide discussion, picking up where we left off, except we are skipping ahead to chapter 3 because I'm going to take the planes discussion from the rest of chapter 2 and kind of move that off to its own series of episodes, so we don't get too bogged down in that, because really what I'm most excited to talk about when it comes to the Dungeon Master's Guide is the rules variants and creating adventures, creating characters, running the game, all that GM focused stuff. The planes, while interesting, and I know some of you want to hear more about them, are pretty niche, mostly used in higher level campaigns, and not even in all of those, where the more general rules discussions and variants and things in the DMG are things that are useful to all DMs. Now, I'm still going to talk about the planes because I have heard from listeners that want to hear more about the planes and are excited about that series. I'm just going to make it its own series, so we don't have to wait to talk about all the planes before we can talk about other things in the Dungeon Master's Guide. So today I'm going to start out chapter 3, and we're going to talk about creating an adventure. Really important discussion today, and covering a lot of topics within that today. We'll talk about the elements of a great adventure, running published adventures versus adventures of your own creation, location-based adventures, event-based adventures, mysteries, intrigues, framing events, moral quandaries, side quests, and more. But before we crack open the DMG, I want to give a quick shout out and a huge thank you to my new patron, Pearson. Thank you so much, Pearson. I really, really appreciate it. And also, while I'm at it, I'm going to give a shout out to patron Jesse as well. Jesse's not a new patron, but he did recently upgrade to a higher tier. He leveled up as a patron. So thank you so much to the two of you, and thank you to all the patrons. I could not, would not do this without your support. Also, I've had a couple listeners express interest to me in sharing their homebrew RPG settings with you, the Game Masters Journey community. And I love this. I'm all for this. I've been hoping this would become a thing all along since we first started talking about world building way back in season one. So I'm really happy that some of you are wanting to share some of the stuff you've come up with as far as your world that you're building. That's great. And I want this to happen. As you know, our community, the Game Master's Journey community, has a couple outlets right now. We've got a server on Discord, and we have a Google Plus community. But unfortunately, neither of those are really well suited for sharing homebrew content and other things like that. Mainly because in both of those, content gets buried the older it is. It just shows you posts chronologically. So if someone posts something about their homebrew world a year later, good luck finding that. So I want to find a better solution for people that want to do that. And also for other things I want to do with the community, we need a better solution. And this would not replace the Discord server. And at least to begin with, would not replace the Google Plus community. This would be in addition. Now, I've actually been thinking about establishing a presence for our community somewhere else for quite a while anyway, because Google doesn't seem to be putting much development or support into Google Plus lately. And I personally predict, I think the writing's on the wall here, that eventually they're going to stop supporting Google Plus the way they've abandoned other services that they used to offer and no longer support, which is not to say they're going to shut it off. That's usually not the way Google does things. They just won't do anything else with it, and it'll sit there as is, and they're not going to develop it. They're not going to promote it. And I mean, they haven't been promoting it since the beginning. So we actually have a really vibrant community on Google Plus. We just topped 1,000 members. I think we're at 1,002 right now, which is awesome and very active. And there are some very active communities on Google Plus, many of them RPG communities, but as a whole, Google Plus is not super active and is not a draw to new users. I think most these days, most of the people that are using Google Plus have been using it for a while. We're not seeing a whole lot of new users come to Google Plus. And the ones that I hear from are coming there just to join the Game Master's Journey community. They really have no interest in Google Plus. That's just where the community is. So because of all that, I've been wanting to come up with something else anyway, so that when that day comes, we're ready and we're not, we don't want all our eggs in the Google Plus basket, I don't think. So, you know, there are various options. There's a Facebook group. Unfortunately, that has all the same problems as a Google Plus community and a Discord server, as far as not being able to find content on there easily, not being able to organize it. Just like a Google Plus community, you can only sticky one post, that kind of thing. So that's not going to work. So I think that the best solution for us is a forum. So I'm considering setting up a forum for Game Master's Journey. Now, I already have a forum set up that I use for my Hinterlands of Alandria campaign, so it wouldn't be a big deal to add public areas of that forum and just use that, or I could set up a different forum. You know, I'd have to decide what would work better. So it'd take a little time to set up a forum. It will take time to moderate it and all that good stuff. So I don't want to do it if no one's going to use it. So please let me know. Shoot me an email, gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can tweet me on Twitter @LexStarwalker. You can send me a message on Google Plus or even on Facebook. I'll see it eventually. I don't go to Facebook every day, but I will see it eventually. I go there a few times a week. But get a hold of me. Let me know if you would like a forum and if you would use it. You don't really need to let me know if you wouldn't use it or wouldn't like a forum. I'm just looking for how many people will say, yes, I would like a forum, and yes, I will use it. And if enough people say they will use it, then I may do it. But otherwise, I probably won't. So I think a forum would be ultimately better for us than the Google Plus community, because it can be more organized. I can set up sub forums with topic areas. For instance, we could have an area for GMs to share their world building. We could have an area for comments on the show. We could have an area for GM questions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's also a lot easier to find content on a forum, especially as it ages, because you can sticky things in all those areas and you can organize, and it's just a lot easier because you can, on one screen, you can see dozens of posts instead of a handful like you would see on a Google community or a Facebook group. So I think it would serve us really well. I'm just curious how many people would use it. So let me know. I'd love to hear from you on that, or anything RPG related, or anything at all, really. I'd love to hear from you. All right, so without further ado, we are going to progress with this show, and we're going to crack open our Dungeon Master's Guide and start talking about creating adventures. Welcome back to the Game Master's Journey series on the Dungeon Master's Guide. So we went through the Player's Handbook in previous seasons and discussed the rules and GM relevant bits within the Player's Handbook. And now we're doing the same thing with the Dungeon Master's Guide. Now, as I've discussed in previous episodes, I'm going to put a pin in our planes discussion for right now. I am going to return to the planes at some point and do a whole series on the various planes, like we started with the astral plane. However, I didn't want to get too bogged down in that, because what I'm really wanting to do with these episodes in which we dig into the Dungeon Master's Guide is talk about creating our adventures and our campaigns and our characters, as well as discussing the various variants of the rules that you can consider and or use, and the different options that you have as a GM to customize your D&D game to what you want it to be. And I'm really excited to talk about that stuff. And so, like I said, we're going to put a pin in the planes episodes. I'm going to do a separate series on those sooner or later. But right now, we're going to skip ahead to chapter 3 in the DMG, Creating Adventures. Now, if you're new to this series, basically what I do is I go through the Dungeon Master's Guide page by page. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. I'll read passages, but we go through it page by page, paragraph by paragraph, and I pull out anything that I want to discuss or comment on, etc. So if you have a copy of the DMG and you want to follow along, today we're starting on page 71. This is chapter 3, Creating Adventures. Creating adventures is one of the greatest rewards of being a dungeon master, and I would agree with that. It's a way to express yourself, designing fantastic locations and encounters with monsters, traps, puzzles, and conflicts. When you design an adventure, you call the shots. You do things exactly the way you want to do. Now, right here, I will point out that this is true whether you're creating your own adventure or you're running an adventure someone else created and wrote. You are the GM, you call the shots. And if there are things you want to change or do differently in your published adventure, then you should definitely do so. Now, I, not too long ago, published my own adventure for Dungeons & Dragons called The Trickster's Labyrinth, and you can grab a copy of that at the store at StarWalkerStudios.com. And I've gotten some great feedback from GMs who've run the Trickster's Labyrinth. And a lot of the feedback turns out being GMs telling me what they changed about the adventure to make it work for their group. And that's fantastic that that's what you should be doing. Every writer or designer of RPG adventures I've ever heard talk on the subject has said that they want GMs to take their adventures and change them however they need to make it work for their group of players at their table. And that's definitely true for me. Just recently, I had a listener GM commenting about the DCs I set for some of the perception checks in the Trickster's Labyrinth, and basically saying that he found those target numbers too low for his group, and he changed them because if he would have used the DCs I suggested in the adventure, he felt like it would have been too easy and they would have just automatically succeeded at all those roles because he had some players with high passive perception. And that's awesome. And as a GM running a published adventure, that's what you should be doing. You should be going through the adventure before you run it and looking for anything you want to flag that you think needs to change based on your players. So DCs of checks is one of those things. Compare the DCs of the adventure with your actual player character's abilities. You know, you may be in a situation like I'm describing where, for instance, the perception checks are all below the passive perception of your player characters, and they're going to just automatically succeed at all those checks. Now, that could be fine depending on the adventure and could be great. Or there may be some of those checks that you want to be more challenging. So you can change those numbers. You can change encounters, you know, what types of monsters, how many of monsters they encounter. You can change the loot that they get. You can change everything, the NPCs, the maps, everything. It's all there. When you get a published adventure, it's all there just to help you, to give you something to start from. It's not necessarily something that you're going to run, quote, out of the box. And I think that the more you make an adventure your own, the more you customize it to what's going to work for your group, the more you're going to get out of that. And if you need to do that, that's not a bad designer writing a bad adventure. That's the adventure in the game working as intended. Because, for instance, when I created Trickster's Labyrinth, I can't make it for your group. I can only make it for a, quote, average adventuring party, whatever that means. So, you know, I'm assuming a certain number of players of a certain level with certain abilities. But at the end of the day, those are all assumptions, and those assumptions may or may not work with your particular group. Also, you know, another thing that's been pointed out is that encounters in published adventures tend to be kind of easy. And I think, you know, again, that's by design, because adventure designers are assuming this, quote, average party of average adventurers. And then they're also erring on the side of caution, or erring on the side of the player characters being successful when they have to make a decision as far as whether to round up or round down, or what kind of a DC to use for a check. So, for instance, for the Trickster's Labyrinth, I didn't want to set my perception DCs too high, because there was information that was gained through those checks that I wanted groups to have. You know, I didn't really want a situation where a party goes through my dungeon and they don't know what's going on because all the perception checks were too high and they didn't make any of them. You know, my goal as a designer was, in most groups, somebody in the group is going to succeed at this check. They're not all going to succeed, but someone will. And, you know, maybe they'll miss one or two, but overall, they're going to get all the information. So those are all things to think about when you're customizing an adventure that you're running. But these are also things to think about when you're designing your own adventure. Fundamentally, adventures are stories. An adventure shares many of the features of a novel, a movie, etc. Comic series and serialized television dramas are particularly good comparisons because of the way individual adventures are limited in scope but blend together to create a larger narrative. If an adventure is a single issue or episode, a campaign then is the series as a whole. So perfect example of this is a new show I love, Star Trek Discovery, right? So this is exactly this kind of thing. Each episode of the show is a self-contained story with a beginning, middle, end, a climax and resolution. Would be like an adventure in an RPG. But then the series overall, the season overall, and the collection of all the seasons overall tell a larger story. Now, I'm old enough that I remember when this wasn't the norm in television, and we had a lot of sitcoms, and TV shows were more episodic. And a perfect comparison would be, let's compare Star Trek Discovery with Star Trek, the original series. For the most part, the original Star Trek show, you could watch those episodes in any order. It didn't matter. And that's how shows were back then. You know, a average TV show returned to a kind of a reset state at the end of every episode. At the beginning and end of every episode, the characters are in this kind of status quo state. And because of that, you could watch episodes in any order. It didn't matter. You could miss episodes and it didn't matter. But more and more in recent decades, television shows have gone from that episodic format to a more serialized format, like in Star Trek Discovery, where not only is there a story in each individual episode, but the episodes together connect and tell a larger story. And I think the reason for that, and I think this is fairly obvious, is because of things like TiVo and digital streaming services and things like that. When I was a kid growing up watching Star Trek, the original series, I had to sit down and watch TV at a specific time, on a specific day, on a specific channel, or I missed it. Right now it was in reruns at this time, but the same thing applied. You know, if I wasn't able to watch Star Trek when it was on, then I missed that episode. And that was the case for everybody. So they had to make TV shows in such a way that if you weren't catching every episode, you could still follow along and you'd still want to watch. Nowadays, that's less of a problem because most people, I think, have some way of getting their television on demand, whether that's using something like TiVo, where you're kind of recording it and watching it later, or you're using something like Netflix or Amazon Prime, where you just watch it whenever you want to watch it. You're streaming it on demand. So because of that, we can have these more serialized stories and we can tell these larger stories. And personally, I find that a much more satisfying type of storytelling. I get a lot more from recent iterations of Star Trek, like Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, and now Discovery, where it's not just each episode is a self-contained thing, but it's more of a larger story that goes over an entire season and the entire show. And I find those stories much more rewarding than, for instance, the original series of Star Trek, where, you know, there was a lot less of that carry through from episode to episode to episode. So that's another thing you can think of when you're thinking about your RPG campaign is, do I want to be episodic or serialized? And, you know, there are pros and cons to both. Episodic would be more like a Wes Marches campaign, where, you know, you're getting back to this reset state at the end of every session. So it doesn't matter if certain players miss certain sessions, it's not a problem. Where the serialized version is probably more like most of us run our games, where it's an ongoing story. And then, of course, a possible downside of that is if a player misses a given session, it can be a little bit more of a headache to deal with. Well, where's their character? What's going on with their character right now? Than it is with an episodic setup. So there's pros and cons to both. But, you know, personally, I think if you're really wanting to get the most out of your storytelling, then serialized is the way to go. All right. So this chapter is going to be useful to you, whether you're running your own adventures or using published adventures. So now we're going to talk about what is an adventure and what, in the opinion of the folks at Wizards of the Coast that wrote this book, makes a good adventure. So what are the elements of a great adventure? So first, we need a credible threat. An adventure needs a threat worthy of the hero's attention. The threat might be a single villain or a monster, a villain with lackeys, an assortment of monsters, or an evil organization. Whatever their nature, the antagonist should have goals that the heroes can uncover and thwart. So, you know, at any point in your campaign, you want to have some kind of credible threat that the player characters are struggling against. And in the course of a campaign, there can be many of these, right? You know, they deal with one threat when they're first level, they deal with another threat when they're third level, and so on. We also want familiar tropes with clever twists. It might seem stereotypical to build an adventure around dragons, orcs, and insane wizards and towers, but these are staples of fantasy storytelling. It might also seem trite to begin an adventure in a tavern, but that's an idea that remains true to D&D. Familiar story elements are fine as long as you and the players occasionally put a spin on them, and I would add as long as you enjoy them. You can run the most cliched, unoriginal adventure ever, and if the players have a blast, it's a win. Conversely, you could run the most original, you know, you've never seen this before, unique, bizarre adventure ever, and if the players don't have a fun time, it's a loss, right? So what's really important for an RPG is how much fun is everybody having, much more so than how original is my adventure. So they suggest that in addition to, you know, are you having fun, that you can also use these familiar tropes and whatnot and put some kind of a spin on them, put a new twist to it. So for example, the mysterious figure who presents the adventurers with a quest on behalf of the king might be the king in disguise, or could be a dragon. The crazy wizard in the tower might be a projected illusion created by a band of greedy gnome thieves to guard their loot. Now, I'll point out that a lot of these twists have themselves become tropes, but that's okay. You know, as a writer, if you're writing novels or screenplays or something like that, usually try to avoid cliches as much as possible. But in a D&D game, cliches are our bread and butter. I often say without cliches, there'd be nothing left in D&D. D&D is built on cliches. We also want a clear focus on the present. Now, I've definitely seen GMs go astray here. So an adventure is about the here and now. A little bit of history might be needed to set the story in motion. And the adventurers might discover interesting lore of the past during the course of the adventure. However, in general, let the world's history be evident in the present situation. Instead of dealing with what happened in the past, an adventure should focus on describing the present situation, what the bad guys are up to, and how the adventurers become involved in the story. Now, I love to pull in concepts from writing because I'm a writer and I pay a lot of attention to writing techniques and whatnot. And as far as storytelling overall, a good story starts with something changing. Think about any story you like, whether it's a book or a movie or a TV show, and you will see that in the very beginning of that story, something is changing for the character, something is changing in the world, something is changing, and a big part of that story is about how do we react to this change? What are the consequences of this change? So when you're thinking about an adventure that you're designing, think about what's happening right now and what is changing right now. What's changing in the lives of these player characters right now, and use that as your launching off point. For a good adventure, we also want heroes who matter. An adventure should allow the adventurer's actions and decisions to matter. Though it might resemble a novel or a TV episode, an adventure needs to allow for more than one outcome. Otherwise, the players can feel as if they've been railroaded. Oh boy, here we go with that term again. Set onto a course that has only one destination, no matter how hard they try to change it. For example, if a major villain shows up before the end of the adventure should allow for the possibility that the heroes might defeat that villain. Yeah, and this is really important, and this is one of the many things that will separate the great GMs from the not-so-great GMs, And one of those things that as a GM, the more experience you get, the more comfortable you get with this and the better you get at this. But really, in a nutshell, you can't assume anything when it comes to players, when it comes to what they're going to decide to do, what they're going to say to NPCs, what plot hook or what story hook they're going to chase after. You really can't assume anything. Now, a lot of us as GMs, I know I do this, as part of our preparation for a given game session, we go through this mental exercise of imagining how we think the players are going to approach this so that we can kind of plan ahead and kind of prepare some contingencies and think about, oh, well, what do I do if they do this? What do I do if they do that? And that's a good exercise. I would not discourage you from doing that, because it gets you thinking about the different ways this could go and the different ways you can react and the different ways the NPCs will react based on these different possible ways that the players could approach it. So it's a great exercise to do, and it will help you improvise in the moment for sure. But the important thing is to remember that it is just an exercise, and more likely than not, whatever the players do decide to do will not be one of the things you thought of ahead of time. But that's okay. Just by going through that exercise of thinking about what are the ways the players might approach this, you've kind of stretched your brain a little bit and you've given some thought to the different ways this can go, which will make it a lot easier for you to decide how to handle on the fly whatever kooky things the players actually end up doing. Now, I've talked about the term railroading a lot on this show and how, first of all, railroading isn't in itself necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it can be just what the doctor ordered with a new group, especially if there's relatively inexperienced players in that group with a new adventure, things like that. Even experienced players will often appreciate a more linear or, quote, railroaded adventure to start a campaign to get them going. In my opinion, a big part of whether, quote, railroading will be perceived as a bad thing by the players or perceived as no big deal, the difference between those two things really has to do with execution, has to do with how you do the railroading as a GM. Is not just, is it railroaded or not? And by railroaded, what I mean, that term in itself has a negative connotation. What we're really talking about is a more linear setup where, you know, the player characters are going to go from A to B to C to D. You know, a lot of published adventures are by necessity very linear. But, you know, like I've discussed on the show before, you could have two different GMs run the same adventure. One GM runs it in such a way that the players feel like they had no agency and feel like they were railroaded the whole time. The other GM runs the exact same adventure in a way that the players feel like they have all the agency they need, feel like they chose their route every step of the way, and don't feel railroaded at all. It's all about finesse. It's all about how you execute. But that's a topic for another day. And like I said, I've already talked about that a lot on the show. So you can check out previous episodes for more on that kind of thing. All right. So in a good adventure, we want something for all player types. As outlined in the book's introduction, which we discussed in previous episodes, players come to the gaming table with different expectations. An adventure needs to account for the different players and characters in your group, drawing them into the story as effectively as possible. So I'll make a clarification here. You know, this says something for all player types, but a more correct way to say this is something for all player types at your table. Now, if you're designing an adventure for a publication, then yes, you want to consider all the different player types or all the different things in an adventure different players will enjoy. Because you want your published adventure to appeal to as many players and as many groups as possible. But if you're creating an adventure to run for your own group, all you need to worry about is the players at your table. So if you've got players that love intrigue, then you probably want to have some intrigue in there. If you got players that love combat, you want to have some combat in there. But if you don't have any players that love intrigue, then you maybe don't need to worry about having intrigue in there. So, you know, always customize for your players, whether it's something you're designing yourself or something you're taking that's published and making it work for your group. So again, they point out that they've set up these three tiers of play: exploration, social interaction, and combat. So that's a tool you can use when thinking about, you know, is this adventure going to appeal to the different types of players? Is, you know, are you covering those three pillars? If not equally, at least addressing all three of them. But again, this should be tailored to your individual players. Maybe you have players that don't care for combat, so the combat pillar can take a back seat. Another important part of a great adventure is surprises. Look for opportunities to surprise and delight your players. For example, the exploration of a ruined castle on a hill might lead to the discovery of a dragon's tomb hidden underneath. A trek through the wilderness might lead to the discovery of a tower that appears only on nights of the full moon. Players remember such locations. On the other hand, too many surprises can be off-putting to players, but adding the occasional twist gets players to adjust their tactics and think creatively. For example, you could spruce up a goblin lair by including goblin sappers with kegs of oil strapped to their backs. An attack on a villain's estate might be complicated by the unexpected arrival of a special guest. When you're preparing for possible combat encounters, you can think about odd pairings of monsters, such as a hobgoblin warlord and his pet manticore, or will-o-wisps in league with a young black dragon. Have surprise reinforcements show up, or give the monsters unusual tactics. Throw in the occasional red herring, deception, and plot twist to keep players on their toes, but try not to go overboard with this. Sometimes a simple, straightforward encounter with an orc guard is just as fun for your players. And I would add to not only spice it up, but change it up. Don't always do the same thing. You know, if you're having lots of red herrings and plot twists and things like that, then yeah, it's probably time to do something straightforward to keep some variety. And again, we're trying to appeal to as many players at our table as we can. And not everybody likes the same thing all the time. Another helpful part of a good adventure is useful maps. A good adventure needs thoughtfully constructed maps. Wilderness areas sprinkled with interesting landmarks and other features are better than vast expanses of unchanging terrain. Dungeons that have branching corridors and similar decision points give players the opportunity to choose which direction their characters go. Presenting the characters with options allows the players to make choices that keep the adventure unpredictable. If drawing maps isn't your strong suit, the internet is a great place to look for adventure maps that have been made freely available for use, as well as floor plans of real-world buildings and images that can inspire your map making. You can also use various types of software to help put your maps together. So yeah, maps can be very helpful. Next, we have a discussion of published adventures, and you know, I've already talked about this, just basically that, you know, you can and should make any alterations and modifications to a published adventure that you feel you need or want to make it work better for your group. So, for example, you could replace the villain of an adventure with one the players have already encountered in your campaign. Or you could add something to the background of the adventure so that it involves your player characters in ways that the designer of the adventure never could have imagined. A published adventure can't account for every action the characters take. The nice thing about published adventures is that they allow you to focus your game prep time on highlighting plot developments in your campaign that the adventure can't address. Published adventures can also provide inspiration. You might not use an adventure as written, but it might spur ideas, or you can pull out one part of it and repurpose that part for your needs. I would also add that there's endless sources of good inspiration for adventures: TV shows, books, comic books, movies, video games, etc., etc., etc. Now, obviously, Wizards wants you to buy their published adventures, but you know, someone like me can point out that you don't need them. And for every upside you could name for running a published adventure versus your own, there are downsides as well. All right, so those are the elements of a good adventure. Now let's talk a little bit about the structure of an adventure. So very simply, like any good story, an adventure will have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the beginning, an adventure starts with a hook to get the characters interested. So we talk about hooks a lot on this show, and a hook is just simply something that you think will make one or more of the players and their characters interested in pursuing this quest, pursuing this adventure, learning more about this NPC, or whatever it is you want them to do. And again, this is part of the technique that we can use as GMs to direct our players where we want them to go and to do the things we want them to do without them feeling like they're railroaded. Again, it's all technique. It's all finesse. If you give a player a compelling hook that the player is interested in and that it makes sense that the character would be interested in, they're going to be on board and they're going to feel like they chose that. They're not going to feel like you forced them to do it. The beginning of a good adventure should be exciting and focused. You want the players to go home looking forward to the next session, so to give them a clear sense of where the story is headed, as well as something to look forward to. So next we have the middle of the adventure. This is where the bulk of the story unfolds. With each new challenge, the adventurers make important choices that have a clear effect on the conclusion of the adventure. Over the course of the adventure, the characters might discover secrets that reveal new goals or change their original goal. Their understanding of what's going on around them might change. Maybe rumors of treasure were a trick to lure them into a death trap. Perhaps a so-called spy in the Queen's court is actually a scheme concocted by the monarch herself to seize even more power. And again, like any tool, this can be overused, so don't overuse it. Again, I'll go back to my metaphor of game mastering tools being like spices when you're cooking, right? When you're putting salt in your food, you don't want to put too much salt in. Putting too much salt in is as bad or even worse than not putting any salt in, right? You want to put just the right amount in. So any of these techniques that we talk about can be overdone, can be overused. So variety is the spice of life. Also remember that at the same time that the adventurers, your player characters, are working to thwart their adversaries, those adversaries are trying to carry out their various nefarious plans. Such enemies might also work to hide their deeds, mislead potential adversaries, or confront problems directly, perhaps by trying to kill meddlers, like the player characters. So that's a common exercise I do in between sessions, and I usually will do this pretty soon after I run a session, is I think about all of the various NPCs I have NPCs that the player characters interacted with that session, NPCs that I've set up as adversaries to the player characters in some way, and just NPCs that might be observing what's going on. And I think about, okay, what happened in this last session? What did the player characters do? And how are these various NPCs going to feel about what the player characters did? And how are they going to react to that? And that very often does a lot to inform what I'm going to do with the next session, is just thinking about what the various NPCs are going to do based on what the player characters have done. And you've got all that time between the two sessions to figure that out and think about how you want to handle that. And that is going to do a lot to not only make your players feel like they have agency and that they have important choices to make and those choices have consequences, it's also going to make your world feel more real and more dynamic and more alive. And it's going to help the players to feel like, hey, we have an impact on this world. Our actions and our inactions matter. And, you know, that's something I come back to a lot on this show. And just anytime I'm talking about GMing, is everything the player characters do should have consequences. Every decision they make should have consequences, just like in real life, right? If you do something or you don't do something, there are consequences. They could be good, they could be bad, they could be neutral. Same thing with player characters. And part of player agency, I believe, isn't just saying, hey, you can do one of these five things. Which one do you want to do? That's part of it. But the other side of the coin, a very important part of player agency, is also letting them enjoy or not the consequences of those choices. If I give you five doors to choose from, but all five doors lead to the same place, that's not a choice. That's not agency. It's a choice, but it's a meaningless choice. And it's really railroading disguised, right? I'm putting up smoke and mirrors and saying, hey, there's five doors here. Which way do you want to go? But I know that they all go to the same place. Or maybe I've only figured out what's behind one of the doors, and whichever door the players pick, that's what they find. Of course, I better hope they don't decide to try two doors, right? So you'll see people recommend this kind of GMing where you just adjust your adventure or what you're doing to fit whatever the players happen to choose. And I'm very much opposed to that philosophy and that style of GMing, because I think that it's a ripoff. It's destroying player agency, because I feel like there are two sides or two aspects to player agency. One is giving them a choice, a meaningful choice that matters, not a false choice or a lack of choice disguised as a choice. So first, you got to give them a meaningful choice to make. And second, there have to be consequences to that choice. And those consequences may be good, they may be bad. It depends on the situation, right? But there should be consequences. And I know that some GMs are reluctant to play out the obvious negative consequences of player character actions or inactions, because they want to be friendly to the players, or they want the players to have fun and they want them to succeed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if that's you, just understand that D&D and other games like this, it's not just a story. We're not reading a novel. We're not watching a movie. It's a game. And part of a game is that there are winners and losers, right? There are rules. Things don't always go your way in a game, right? And the players are coming to play a game. And a game where there's no challenge isn't any fun. It's not worth playing. Maybe you've been in a situation where you're playing a game, like could be a sport, could be something like a card game, like Magic the Gathering, could be euchre, could be poker, could be whatever. But you're playing a game against another person, and that person is no match for you, right? So I don't know. Let's take an example. Let's say Magic, right? I'm familiar with Magic. Let's say you're playing Magic against some guy, just started playing Magic. He doesn't know what he's doing. And it doesn't matter how many mistakes you make. It doesn't matter what cards you draw. You're going to defeat this player just because they don't know what they're doing. They're not in your league. They're not a real challenge. Now, you might enjoy that for a few hands and feel all powerful and like, oh, look how awesome I am. I'm stomping this guy into the dirt. But eventually you're going to realize, well, I'm really not awesome because this guy isn't on my level. And it's like taking candy from a baby, and there's no pride to be taken from that. And once you realize that, it's not going to be fun anymore. It's going to be boring and you're not going to want to do it anymore. So the same thing with an RPG, where whatever choice the players make just happens to be the right choice, or where there's never negative consequences for what they do or don't do, etc. It's not going to be fun. There's not going to be any challenge. It's not going to be compelling. There's not going to be any suspense. There's not going to be any tension. And they're going to get bored. So don't be afraid. If your players do something stupid, if their characters do something stupid, and you think, okay, this should go very badly for them because they did this stupid thing, let it happen. Let them see the consequences of their action. Don't have some NPC fly in and save them, or even worse, just ignore that consequence that should have happened. Because the players are smart. They're going to realize, oh, you know, We totally lied to the Baron and he found out there should have been some fallout for that. And there wasn't. The DM just ignored it. So I guess we're playing on easy mode here. And this game suddenly isn't nearly as fun as I thought it was going to be. So do not be afraid to let the players suffer those consequences. And often the best gaming sessions are when things go really wrong because the players made a dumb decision, or they made a decision based on faulty information, or they just did the wrong thing. And now, you know, they've jumped from the frying pan into the fire, and now they have to salvage the situation and they have to figure out what they're going to do. Those are often the most enjoyable sessions, and players love that stuff. They love a challenge. They love the, oh crap, we got ourselves into this mess. Now we have to get ourselves out of it. It's a lot of fun. So don't miss that opportunity. And it will be difficult the first time until you get used to it. And you will probably be scared of angering your players or whatever. But trust me, your game will be much more enjoyable for everybody if there are real consequences for everything the players do and don't do than there will be if just things always go the player's way. And finally, remember that the characters, the player characters, are the heroes of the story. Never let them become mere spectators, watching as events unfold around them that they can influence. Clarification or putting an even finer point on this, the player characters are the hero of the story, not the non-player characters. I see so many times in games I played in or games I watch on YouTube or podcasts I listen to where the hero of the story is really one or more of the NPCs and the player characters are just along for the ride. I've been listening to an actual play recently. I'm not going to say which it is because I don't want to bag other GMs, but I'm listening to this actual play and all of the major decisions are being made by NPCs, right down to battle strategies. I just listened to one the other day where they were facing this big battle and the player characters were, you know, discussing, you know, how are we going to handle this? And a couple NPCs laid out the whole battle strategy for them. They're like, this is what you should do. And this is what you should do. And blah, 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 blah. And sure, the GM justified it by saying, well, this is what this character would do. But that's not an excuse. I mean, the GM chose to have that character there. The GM chose to have that character say and do those things. That was all GM choice. The GM's hands were not tied. And, you know, the player character should be coming up with a battle plan, not the NPCs. You know, and sometimes you'll have players who are constantly wanting NPCs to make decisions for them. They'll constantly be asking NPCs, what should we do? You know, blah, 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 blah. And so you might feel like, oh, well, then it's okay because they asked for it. It's okay to let my NPC to tell them what to do, which is really, when you think about it, the GM telling them what to do. But it's not okay. Think of a way to put it back on the player character. Maybe the NPC doesn't have time to come up with a battle plan for them. They're like, hey, you come up with a battle plan. That's why I hired you. That's why I asked you to do this quest, because I want you to do it. I don't want to do it. Or some other reason that the NPC isn't available or isn't able to help them out beyond, you know, maybe giving them a few hints or something. But make, you know, the player characters are the heroes of the story. They should be making the big decisions. They should be making battle plans. They should be directing where the story goes, how it unfolds, how the conflicts are resolved. You know, you might be tempted as a DM, you know, they're going to go against your big, bad, evil guy at the end. You might be tempted to give them, you know, oh, well, remember, he's immune to fire, so you don't want to use fire magic. Or, you know, oh, remember, you know, you've figured out that he has really low wisdom saves, so charm will work well on him. You know, don't do it. You're going to be tempted to give them all the answers, and you don't want to do that. And, you know, not only is that taking the decision away from the players and making the story less about them and their characters, but it's also, when you think about it, it's really railroading, because you're basically saying, you know, to put it in MMO terms, you're basically saying, I came up with this boss fight and here are all the mechanics. Here's how you win the fight. And you're basically, the players are just painting by numbers, right? So you don't want to do that. You want to let the player characters decide how they're going to fight the boss. Let them remember or not the various things that they should have learned about the boss by now. And let the dice fall as they will, and let the consequences be what they logically should be, even if that consequence is failure on the part of the player characters. I'd say better an earned failure than an unearned success. And then finally, of course, we have the ending of an adventure. The ending encompasses the climax, the scene or encounter in which the tension building throughout the adventure reaches its peak. A strong climax should have the players on edge, with the fate of the characters and much more hanging in the balance. The outcome, which hinges on the characters' actions and decisions, should never be a foregone conclusion. An ending needn't tie everything up in a neat bow. Story threads can be left hanging, waiting to be resolved in a later adventure. A little bit of unfinished business is an easy way to transition from one adventure to another. So that's another thing I hear about a lot from listener GMs asking me, you know, how do you go from one adventure to another? How do you transition? And, you know, one great technique is foreshadowing. So if you know you're going to run a certain adventure next, you can start to foreshadow that by having, for instance, the player characters meet an NPC from that next adventure in this adventure and set up that NPC as someone they know so that it seems less out of the blue when that NPC comes to them with a hook for the next adventure. So foreshadowing can be a great way to set up that next adventure and make that transition a smooth one. And another great technique can be what they're talking about here. Have some unresolved plot threads, especially if you have some plot threads in your current adventure that, or with what's going on with the player character's backstory or whatever, that will very elegantly and naturally lead into this next adventure, then that is definitely a plot thread that you not only want to leave unresolved, but towards the end of that first adventure, kind of shine a light on it somehow through the story or what happens in the adventure. Remind the player characters of, hey, you've got this thing you haven't dealt with yet. And then that will naturally lead them to the next adventure. And again, we'll make it seem like something they're choosing to do of their own agency, as opposed to, oh, the DM wants us to do this adventure now. So I guess that's what we're doing. We have no choice.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to take a minute to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. It's because of the patrons that all the listeners of Game Master's Journey enjoy a bonus episode every month, as well as the monthly Game Master's Journey live stream. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 5 patron, Steve. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
The man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. To continue our discussion of creating adventures for RPGs, let's think a little bit about some of the different types of adventures you can run. One type of adventure that we're very familiar with in D&D is location-based adventures. Adventures set in crumbling dungeons and remote wilderness locations are the cornerstone of countless campaigns. Many of the greatest D&D adventures of all time are location-based. Creating a location-based adventure can be broken down into a number of steps. Each step provides tables from which you can select the basic elements of your adventure. Alternatively, roll on the tables and see how the random results inspire you. You can mix up the order of steps. So step one, identify the party's goals. So we have three tables here to help you with thinking about the goal of a location-based adventure. We've got a table for dungeons, one for wilderness, and an other kind of miscellaneous table. So I'll give you a few examples from each table. So here are some examples of goals for a location-based adventure that takes place in a dungeon. Perhaps the PCs need to rescue a captive. Maybe they need to discover the nature and origin of a strange location or phenomenon, or pursue fleeing foes taking refuge in the dungeon, or parlay with a villain in the dungeon. So there are 19 options here on this table. That's just a few of them, of possible reasons that players could be lured to go to a dungeon. And again, you know, this is to preserve that feeling of player agency by giving them a good reason and letting them make that choice of, hey, let's go to this dungeon because that's where the dude is that we need to talk to. Some examples of goals for a wilderness location adventure. Perhaps they need to assess the scope of a natural or unnatural disaster. Maybe they need to stop monsters from raiding caravans and farms, or establish trade with a distant town, or map a new land. Again, just a few examples from this table. There are 19 total on each of these tables. Well, those two anyway. And then other goals. Seize control of a fortified location, such as a fortress, town, or ship. Retrieve an object from a caravan. Break a prisoner out of jail or prison camp. So, you know, we've got a lot of tables in this book. And in this section, you know, we've got some tables that can help you if you're designing a location-based adventure and you're thinking, what is a hook I can use to get the player characters interested in exploring this dungeon or wilderness location or whatever. You can find lots of ideas here. The next step in designing a location-based adventure is to identify important NPCs. So we've got some tables here to help you. We've got adventure villains, table there, adventure allies, and adventure patrons. So, you know, of course, the villain is the bad guy, right? The antagonist of the adventure. Could be a beast or monstrosity with no particular agenda. Or it could be a dragon bent on domination and plunder. Or a fae creature with a mysterious goal. Adventure allies are NPCs that can be of help to the player characters during this adventure. Maybe a skilled adventurer, or a soldier, or a priest, or a sage, etc., etc. And then adventure patrons. Patron is someone who basically gives the player characters quests, sends them on adventures. Someone who sees potential in these young adventurers and is willing to pay them to do tasks. So the patron could be a retired adventurer or a local ruler or a military officer or a temple official. And there are other options here too. So again, these tables can be very useful to you, whether you roll on them or choose things from them or just use them to inspire your own ideas. The next step of creating a location-based adventure would be to flesh out the location details. So when we get to chapter 5, we'll talk about suggestions for creating and fleshing out an adventure location, including tables that can help you establish the important elements of a dungeon, wilderness area, or urban setting. So we'll talk about that. If you're creating an adventure right now, check out chapter 5. And then step 4, find the ideal introduction. An adventure can begin with a social interaction encounter in which the adventurers find out what they must do and why. Or it could start with a surprise attack, or with the adventurers coming across information by accident. The best introductions arise naturally from the goals and setting of the adventure. And if this isn't the first adventure in the campaign, they arise naturally from what's happening and has already happened in the campaign. So we have a table for this adventure introduction with 12 ideas for you. One is, while traveling in the wilderness, the characters notice the entrance to the adventure location. So that's pretty simple. Now, you know, all of these have pros and cons to them. So a possible downside of this introduction is there's nothing really to motivate the players to go explore that dungeon other than curiosity. So if you really want them to do the dungeon, you might need to give them more than that to really entice them to go inside. The adventurers find a map on a dead body. In addition to the map setting up the adventure, the adventurer's villain wants the map. Or one night, the adventure or the characters all dream about entering the adventure location. So there's just a few from this table. Lots of tables here to help you out. And then step five, consider the ideal climax. Now, again, we can't predict what happens. We can't predict what the players will do. So this ideal climax may not happen the way we envision, but it's good to think about it. The climactic ending of an adventure fulfills the promise of all that came before. Although the climax must hinge on the successes and failures of the characters up to that moment, the adventure climax table can provide suggestions to help you shape the end of your adventure. For example, the actions of the adventurers or the villain result in a cataclysmic event that the adventurers must escape, or a portal opens to another plane of existence. Creatures on the other side spill out, forcing adventurers to close the portal and deal with the villain at the same time. That sounds perfect for Primordia. And then finally, step six, plan the encounters. After you've created the location and the overall story of the adventure, it's time to plan out the encounters that make up that adventure. In a location-based adventure, most encounters are keyed to specific locations on a map. For each room or wilderness area on the map, your key describes what's in that area, its physical features, as well as any encounter that plays out there. The adventure key turns a simple sketch of numbered areas on graph paper into encounters designed to entertain and intrigue your players. And you can see creating encounters later in this chapter, which we'll discuss in a future episode, for more information on that. But of course, not every adventure has to be location-based. Another type of adventure you could run is an event-based adventure. In an event-based adventure, the focus is on what the characters and the villains do and what happens as a result. The question of where those things happen is of secondary importance. Building an event-based adventure is more work than building a location-based one, but the process can be simplified by following a number of straightforward steps. Several of these steps include tables from which you can choose or roll randomly for inspiration. As with the previous location-based adventure discussion, you don't have to do these steps in this order necessarily. So step one, start with a villain. Putting care into creating your villain will pay off later, since the villain plays such a pivotal role in advancing the story. So they have adventure villains table that you can use to help you with that, which we already talked about. For example, your villain might be an undead creature seeking to avenge a past imprisonment or injury. An interesting aspect of an undead villain is that this past injury might have occurred centuries ago, inspiring revenge against the descendants of those that harmed it. Imagine a vampire imprisoned by the members of a religious order of knights and who now seeks revenge against the current members of that order. So once you've got your villain, step two is determine the villain's actions. What's this villain up to? Create a timeline showing what the villain does and when, assuming no interference from the adventurers. And this is really useful, right? Like, think about, okay, I've got this villain. This villain has a goal that he or she is trying to accomplish. What is the villain going to do to achieve that goal? What's the timeline of that look like, assuming the player characters don't interfere at all? And once you've got that figured out, it'll be a lot easier for you to decide how your villain is going to react to what the player characters do based on how they disrupt her plans. So building on their previous example, you might decide that your vampire villain murders several knights. By slipping past locked doors in gaseous form, the vampire is able to make the deaths appear natural at first, but it soon becomes clear that a depraved killer is behind the murders. And if you need inspiration, they have a chart here or a table with some different ideas of how the villain's actions might unfold over the adventure. Something like a crime spree or... Oh, wow. These don't... Okay. They go into more detail on these. I'm like, these aren't very explanatory. Let's go through these real quick. So you could have a big event. The villain's plans come to fruition during a festival, an astrological event, a holy or unholy rite, a royal wedding, the birth of a child, or some other similar fixed time. The villain's activities up to that point are geared toward preparation for this event. You could have a crime spree. The villain commits acts that become bolder and more heinous over time. A killer might start out by targeting the destitute in the city slums before moving up to a massacre in the marketplace, increasing the horror and the body count each time. And it's nice to have escalations like that, because the longer the player characters take to figure out what's going on and deal with it, or the longer they delay before they embark on the adventure, the more things escalate and they see these consequences happening around them. And eventually, hopefully, they realize, hey, we should probably do something about this before it gets even worse. You could have growing corruption. As time passes, the villain's power and influence grow, affecting more victims across a larger area. This might take the form of armies conquering new territory, an evil cult recruiting new members, or a spreading plague. A pretender to the throne might attempt to secure the support of the victims or the kingdom's nobility in the days or weeks leading up to a coup, or a guild leader could corrupt the members of a town council or bribe officers of the watch. One and done. The villain commits a single crime and then tries to avoid the consequences. Instead of an ongoing plan to commit more crimes, the villain's goal is to lie low or flee the scene. Serial crimes. The villain commits crimes one after the other, but these acts are repetitive in nature rather than escalating to greater degrees of depravity. The trick to catching such a villain lies in determining the pattern underlying the crimes. Though serial killers are a common example of this type of villain, your villain could be a serial arsonist, favoring a certain type of building, a magical sickness that affects spellcasters who cast a specific spell, a thief that targets a certain kind of merchant, or a doppelganger kidnapping and impersonating one noble after another. Or step by step, in pursuit of its goal, the villain carries out a specific set of actions in a particular sequence. A wizard might steal the items needed to create a phylactery and become a lich, or a cultist might kidnap the priests of seven good aligned gods as a sacrifice. Alternatively, the villain could be following a trail to find the object of its revenge, killing one victim after another while moving ever closer to the real target. So our next step is to determine the party's goals. A goal can suggest ways in which the adventurers might become caught up in the villain's plans and what exactly they must do to foil those plans. So we have a chart of party goals here that you can look over. But, you know, really, this is going to come from your players, right? Your players are going to be the ones to decide what their goals are. But you can use this to help you think about how you're going to pull the players in. So they give an example. One of the event-based goals here is secure aid from a ruler or council. So if you wanted to go that route, you could decide to connect that to the leadership of the order targeted by your vampire villain. Maybe the order's leaders have a chest of jewels stolen from the vampire centuries ago, and the characters can use the chest as bait to trap the villain. Next step is identify important NPCs. So many event-based adventures require a well-detailed cast of NPCs. Some of these NPCs are going to be allies and patrons, but most are likely to be characters or creatures whose attitudes toward the adventures remain undecided until the PCs interact with them. So again, you know, the consequences, right? I do that a lot with my NPCs. You know, most of my NPCs aren't predetermined to be friendly or hostile to the player characters. It really depends how the player characters interact with them and what they do. Next, you can anticipate the villain's reactions. As the adventurers pursue their goals and foil the villain's plans, how does the villain respond? So yeah, you know, I talked about that, you know, in between sessions, think about how is your villain going to respond to what the player characters did last week. So they suggest that one way to track this is by using a flowchart. So this could grow out of the timeline that you came up with describing the villain's plans, outlining how the villain gets back on track after the adventurers thwart his plans. Or the flowchart could be separate from the timeline, showing the various actions the adventurers might take and the villain's response to those actions. But again, remember, that's an exercise, right? That's a mental exercise, thinking about what might the PCs do and how will the villain respond to that? Because chances are they're going to come up with something you didn't anticipate. But that can be a useful exercise if you have time to help you improvise in the moment. Next, we detail key locations. Since locations aren't the focus of this type of adventure, they can be simpler and smaller than a dungeon complex or an expansive wilderness. They might be specific locations in the city or even individual rooms in locations where combat is likely to break out or significant exploration is needed, such as the throne room, guild headquarters, vampire's crumbling manor, or a knight's chapter house. Next, we choose an introduction and a climax. So, you know, this is very similar to location-based adventures. And you can use those same tables. And finally, we plan the encounters. After you've created the overall story of the adventure, it's time to plan out the encounters on which the events of that adventure will hang. In an event-based adventure, encounters occur when the villain's agenda intersects the path of the characters. You can't always anticipate exactly when or where that will happen, but you can create a list of possible encounters that the adventurers might experience. This can take the form of general descriptions of the villain's forces, details of its lieutenants and minions, as well as encounters tied to the key locations of the adventure. And these would be, you know, what I like to call flexible encounters, encounters that you think about and come up with ahead of time, but aren't necessarily keyed to a specific place or a specific time. Instead, they're keyed to a certain situation arising or the player character is doing a certain thing. And then when or if that happens, you've got your encounter ready to go. And the nice thing about flexible encounters is that they're flexible, which means you have a lot of wiggle room as far as how you're going to work that into a game session, because a lot of times a good flexible encounter can happen anywhere or anytime. So it's a lot easier to just drop that in when you need it. Another type, common adventure type is a mystery. So this is a kind of event-based adventure usually. That focuses on the adventurer's efforts to solve a crime, maybe a robbery or a murder. Now, unlike the writer of a mystery novel, you as a DM can't always predict what the characters will do in a mystery adventure. But you do know who did it, right? You do know that, or you should. So here are some things to think about if you want to build a mystery adventure. Think about the victim and the victim's relationship to your villain. Though you can create a strong scenario with no such relationship, part of what makes a mystery exciting is the discovery of the twisted connections between NPCs and how those connections led to the crime. So this is a great thing to think about. A random killing might be just as mysterious, but it lacks that emotional connection. And it also lacks that thing for the player characters to discover, right? Like, how cool is it when what seemed like a random killing, they figure out wasn't random at all once they do some digging and figure out what's going on with these NPCs? That'll be a fun revelation for the players and a feeling of accomplishing something real. Also look for a connection between the victim and one or more of the adventurers. This will be your hook. One surefire way to draw adventurers into a mystery, including making them suspects, is to make the victim someone with whom the characters are acquainted. Yeah. Yeah. And that could either be an NPC that they've interacted with in the campaign, or it could be an NPC from one of the characters' backstory. And that's a great way to pull in some backstory. And you'll have some buy-in from that player, at least, when you pull in someone from their backstory. You can think about suspects. Your cast of characters should include an assortment of other NPCs who did not commit the crime, but who had the motive, the means, or the opportunity to do so. If there's only one suspect, it's not going to be a very hard mystery to solve, right? Suspects could be obvious or might come to light during the investigation itself. One technique often used in detective fiction is to create a closed circle of suspects, a finite number of individuals whose circumstances make them the only possible suspects. So think of the game Clue, right? You know, there's a murder in this house. There are only so many people in the house at the time. So we know that the murderer must be one of these people, and we start narrowing down from there. One tip for keeping the players in the adventures guessing as to the identity of the villain is to ensure that more than one suspect has a secret. When questioned by the adventurers, a suspect might appear nervous or attempt to lie despite being innocent of the crime. A secret business deal, an illicit affair, a dark past, or an uncontrolled vice or flaws that make suspects more interesting than NPCs with nothing to hide, and also could make them a red herring. Which every good mystery needs some red herrings, right? And you're going to want some clues for your mystery. Clues point to the identity of the villain. Some clues are verbal, including the statements of the suspects and witnesses that help the adventurers develop a picture of what happened. Other clues are physical, such as an unfinished message written in the victim's blood, a piece of jewelry left behind by the villain, or a weapon found hidden in a suspect's room. A clue should connect a suspect to the crime, typically by shedding light on the suspect's motive, means, or opportunity. Some clues, though, connect the wrong suspect to the crime, leading the adventurers in the wrong direction. This is what we call a red herring. Eventually, they must find other clues pointing in a different direction or come across evidence that absolves the current suspect. It's better to populate your adventure with too many clues than too few. If the adventurers solve the mystery too quickly, you might feel some disappointment, but the players will feel a sense of accomplishment. If the mystery is too hard, though, or impossible to solve, the players will become frustrated. Since you have to account for the possibility that the adventurers will overlook some clues, use redundant clues to ensure that the players have the knowledge needed to catch the villain. And finally, this is probably obvious, but just in case it's not, if you as a GM end up solving the mystery adventure for your players, you're doing it wrong. Let them solve the mystery or not. Remember, the story is about the players. It's not about you. It's not about your NPCs. So don't have your brilliant Sherlock Holmes NPC come in and save the day when the players can't figure it out. Maybe you need to come up with more clues or figure out where you went wrong. But the solution to that problem is not to solve the mystery for the players or bring it down to a skill check. Roll a D20, and if you roll a 10 or higher, I'll tell you what the answer is. No, that's not how you run a good mystery. The players figure it out. That's how you run a good mystery. Another type of adventure you can run is an intrigue. This is probably the adventure type in here that I am the least skilled and experienced at, but I'll work on it. Intrigue adventures are event-based adventures that revolve around power struggles. Intrigues are common in the courts of the nobility, but power struggles can play out just as easily in merchants' guilds, crime syndicates, and temple hierarchies. Rather than dark events and villainous plots, an intrigue adventure typically revolves around the exchange of favors, the rise and fall of individuals in power and influence, and the honeyed words of diplomacy. A prince's efforts to be named heir to the throne, a courtier's ambition to sit at the queen's right hand, and a merchant's desire to open a trade route through enemy lands are all the stuff of intrigue. Like all adventures, an intrigue adventure only works if the players and their characters are invested in the outcome. If no one cares who the king's chamberlain is or who has logging rights in the Elven Woods, throwing the characters into an adventure centered on those issues will fall flat. However, if having the ear of the king's chamberlain means the characters can use royal soldiers to help them defend their own stronghold on the borderlands, players will be invested in the scenario. Adventurers usually become embroiled in intrigue when they need a favor from a powerful creature and have to perform a favor in exchange, or when the plots of powerful NPCs get in the way of the characters achieving their goals. Some of the event-based goals discussed earlier in this section lend themselves to intrigue adventures. For example, if the adventurers must uncover a conspiracy, negotiate a peace treaty, or secure aid from a ruler or council, you might be looking at an intrigue adventure. So I will just say, when it comes to these intrigue adventures, you know, player buy-in is really important with any adventure. So as a GM, if you're wanting to do an intrigue adventure, let what the players do, what their characters do, and what happens in the campaign inform you on what that intrigue adventure should be. Just keep your eyes open, pay attention, and wait for an opportunity to present itself. It probably will eventually. The players will just hand you the perfect seed for an intrigue adventure. And then you can create an adventure around what they've done, what they care about, what they've been working on, or whatever that's going on in the campaign. And you'll get that buy-in because this intrigue is a direct consequence of decisions that the players have made. So when it comes to intrigue, what about villains? Some intrigue adventures are driven by the actions of a single villain, such as a noble plotting the assassination of a monarch. However, an intrigue adventure can have multiple villains or no villain at all. So what if you want an adventure with no villain? Some intrigue adventures revolve around the exchange of favors in the absence of a villain. So for this type of adventure, you can skip the first steps of the adventure creation process that we've been talking about, the villain and the villain's actions, because there is no villain. Duh. And move straight to the adventurer's goals in step three. Figure out why the adventurers become involved in the intrigue, then spend the bulk of your time creating the NPCs they interact with. On the other hand, you could have many villains. So your intrigue adventure might feature a whole cast of villains, each with its own goals, motivations, and methods. The adventurers might be drawn into the struggle of a court full of nobles vying for the throne in the wake of the king's death. Or they could find themselves negotiating the end to a deadly turf war among thieves' guilds. So again, you know, here you would spend a lot of time on the first two steps, thinking about the villain and the villain's actions. And, you know, each of the major NPCs is basically going to be a villain in this kind of adventure. And then, you know, when you're thinking about the villain's reactions to what the player characters are doing, you'll want to do that for each of the villains, obviously. Another thing to think about in an intrigue adventure is influence. Depending on the scenario you're running, you might want to track the party's influence with different NPCs or factions, or even track influence separately for each character. And you can refer to the episode I did talking about factions for discussion on how you can do that and set up those factions and track the influence that the player characters have with them. So one way you could handle this influence is to treat it like a currency in the game, kind of like inspiration. So a character would gain influence in a certain situation only if you, the GM, grant it, and bringing their influence into play would basically require them, quote, spending that influence or using it up. Characters can gain influence by doing favors for NPCs, advancing the cause of an organization, or demonstrating their power and heroism at your discretion. As with inspiration, a character can choose to spend influence to gain advantage on a role relevant to that influence. Another way you can handle influence is to treat it like renown, allowing characters to gain renown at court and within various key factions. Okay, so this is more relevant to the discussion of factions. I thought that's what they meant by influence was renown, but they're talking about two separate things here. So you could go either way or you could use both. All right, so an important element you might want to consider for your adventure is a framing event or events. So you can base your entire adventure on a framing event, or you can use a framing event to grab the player's interest at the beginning of the adventure. And they have a table here with numerous events. So I'll rattle off a few just to give you an idea what we're talking about. So it could be an arena event, birthday of an important NPC, a civic festival, appearance of a comet, a coronation, an execution, a full moon, a harvest festival. They've got a lot of festivals in here. A planar conjunction, a planetary alignment, signing of a treaty, things like that. So there's lots of examples in there. You can check it out. So you can use an event like that to as part of the hook to get the players interested in what's going on. And you can also use it just to show that there's more going on in the world than what the player characters are doing, and gives your world some dynamic. And you also might want to think about having some complications in your adventure. You might want it to be very straightforward, or you might not. So one type of complication you could have is moral quandaries. If you want to give the characters a crisis that no amount of spellcasting or swordplay can resolve, add a moral quandary to the adventure. A moral quandary is a problem of conscience for which the adventurers must make a single choice, but never a simple one. And ideally, with a moral quandary, there either is no right answer, or it's unclear what the right answer is, or different players will have different opinions on what the right answer is. And they have to make a decision, and that can be a lot of fun. So they list some different quandaries here. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but you can check it out on page 80 of the DMG. We've got the ally quandary, friend, honor, rescue, and respect quandary. Another thing to think about when designing your adventure is twists. A twist can complicate a story and make it harder for the characters to complete their goals and also keep things interesting and challenge assumptions. So they have a chart here of some possible twists. Maybe the adventurers are racing against other creatures with the same or an opposite goal, or they have a time limit. I don't know that that's a twist unless they don't realize they have a time limit until at some point in the adventure, maybe. The adventurers have two different goals, but they can only complete one, things like that. And then finally, if you want, you can think about side quests. So you could add one or more side quests to your adventure, taking the characters off the main story path defined by location or events. Side quests are peripheral to the character's primary goal, but successfully completing a side quest might provide a benefit toward completing the primary goal. So they have some examples of side quests, could be find a specific item rumored to be in the area, rescue a captive, slay a specific monster, and so on. And not only can you have side quests feed into the goal of the overall adventure, you don't have to, but you can. But not only that, you know, in D&D, side quests can be a great source of experience. If you're using experience and you want the player characters to have some more experience so they can level or whatever, side quests can work for that. Side quests can be great as a way to get some treasure to the player characters. Side quests can be ways to introduce new NPCs and give the players' characters chance to develop some new contacts that could be useful in the future. And finally, a side quest can be a great way to foreshadow and or set up a adventure you want to run after the adventure you're running now. So side quests can be really useful, and sometimes they're just nice for a change of pace. You know, sometimes it's nice, especially with a longer adventure and you're kind of working towards this goal week after week. Sometimes it's nice to take a night off and do something different. So side quests can be great for that. All right. So that wraps up this part of the DMG about creating adventures. Next up, we're going to talk about actually creating encounters, which, you know, is part of creating an adventure. And yeah, we'll discuss that in a future episode. So I'd love to hear from you what you think about creating adventures and what you think about the guidance that's given here in the DMG. Is there anything you think has been overlooked or something else we should discuss on this topic? If so, let me know. You can shoot me an email at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for episode 200 of Game Master's Journey. I want to thank the guitarist from Australia for your 5-star review on iTunes. Guitarist says, I listen to a few different podcasts, and while others may excel in going into specific class mechanics, lore, etc., etc., this podcast has to be my favorite across the board for great advice, useful tips and insights, including practical tips on running games, incorporating cool ideas from other sources, and a really humble viewpoint as you were learning 5e as well, without the usual, oh, they changed this from previous editions. Keep up the great work, and thanks from a patron in Australia. So thank you so much for your review, guitarist. I really appreciate it, and so awesome that I have another listener in Australia. I really love my international listeners. I love all my listeners. But thank you so much. And again, iTunes reviews are a great way that you can help support the show that won't cost you any money, which is pretty sweet. So if you'd like to get a hold of me, there are great ways you can do so. You can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can also call the Game Master's Journey voicemail number and leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you might even hear that message on the show. That number is 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. or you can just find that number in the show notes for this episode. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I'd love to hear from you. You can find those show notes at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey, as well as links to connect with the Game Master's Journey community on Google Plus and Discord, where you can share ideas, questions, and stories with other listener GMs. If you'd like to support the show, the best way you can help me out is by becoming a patron. You can find out all about becoming a patron at patreon.com/Starwalker Studios. Check the bottom of the show notes for all the other ways you can support the show, including purchasing a t-shirt or my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, at starwalkerstudios.com. You can also use my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon. You can find all these ways to support the show and more at starwalkerstudios.com/support. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey.